This week, pirates, porn, and the ungovernable internet.
This woman did decide to leak sex chats to a website called The Dirty. It was only a matter of minutes before some other 23-year-old kid could piece this information together.
When legal alternatives to illegal downloading turned up, the rate of piracy plummeted, in some cases by 90%.
I could try and sort of put up a fight and stop the pirate translation, but nobody would read the book in Russian. And I thought that if the translation was going to be good, I might need to intervene.
He sent pieces of styrofoam flying all over the courtroom, and he explained the exploding bit of styrofoam was a representation of a CD sort of being atomized into individual songs.
You're going to have to end up having a discussion with your spouse or your partner about your porn use, which you may or may not wish to have.
There's more coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Oh, what news this week! Consider Wednesday, a presidential speech on economic inequality, a royal baby name, a New York City mayoral hopeful's digital peccadilloes. When faced with so many great stories, it's hard for us news professionals to set priorities. Here's how Fox did it.
We locked in tax cuts for 98% of Americans, and we asked those at the top to pay a little bit more.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but if you would like to hear more from the president, including the complete coverage of his speech on the economy, check out the Fox Business Network. We're expecting to know the name of the new royal baby in just moments. Plus, Anthony Weiner may be getting more exposure than ever, but the bigger focus may become his wife.
It's awkward doing this show sometimes, not least when we choose to talk about something because it is too much talked about or weirdly reported, or both, like Anthony Weiner, now running for New York City mayor.
They're willing to still continue to give me a second chance. And I hope they
the gossip website The Dirty, tipped by one of Weiner's digital flings, reported that he had had more virtual affairs after he quit the U.S. Congress in 2011. The Dirty carries the disclaimer, postings may contain erroneous or inaccurate information. Nonetheless, BuzzFeed, a site that strives to offer real news alongside its cute cat slideshows, ran with the story. And then it one-upped The Dirty by revealing the name and picture of the alleged tipster. McKay Coppins is BuzzFeed's political editor. McKay, welcome back to the show.
Good to be on.
So, BuzzFeed learned that The Dirty had this story. This is a site that has a preset disclaimer on everything it posts.
You know, we did everything we could to confirm that the transcripts were real. We also, of course, went to the campaign and asked for comment right away. Several hours went by, and we told them at the campaign that we were going to run a story saying, look, this gossip website is making these claims. You haven't responded. We're going to print that.
You don't see anything wrong with that, McKay?
Well, there's a certain media philosophy, especially among old guard media, that we are the gatekeepers, that it is our job to keep untrue information out of the public eye. And the way we do that is by pretending it doesn't exist until we can confirm it. This gossip site had this story up for several hours before we reported it. According to the site, it had already had 100,000 clicks on the story. It's not as though this information was not seen by our readers already.
You're saying it's your job to sort out truth from falsehood, but you're not doing anything like that in this particular story.
Actually, if you looked at our story, we did a lot to sort out truth from fiction. We said they were unverified transcripts. We also went to the source, thedirty.com, and talked about this website's uneven track record of good taste and journalistic ethics. And it also happens to have leaked similar information about another candidate that turned out to be true. And so we saw it as our role to come in and say, look, this is what we know about The Dirty. This is what we know about this information. We're going to stay on the story and let you know as it progresses.
Ultimately, you did manage to identify the woman that Weiner was communicating with. You want to explain how you did that?
We got a tip about who the woman was from a source, and we got our very web-savvy newsroom to look into it. And they found photos on this woman's various social media accounts that matched the not very well blurred photos on The Dirty. We got a bunch of other information from her social media accounts that were public, her making comments about Anthony Weiner in the past.
Why is her name newsworthy?
In this story, there are two main characters. This woman did decide to leak sex chats to a website called The Dirty. It was only a matter of minutes or hours before some other 23-year-old kid could piece this information together. We have a source who is close to this woman who told us that she had, in fact, been carrying on an online relationship with Anthony Weiner. And you'll notice, of course, that other news outlets, including the New York Times, have also reported her name.
Mm-hmm. When the New York Times first reported this story, it was also citing the source as The Dirty. So I guess there's no real difference there. And it's also telling that when the New York Times began to run with the story, they quoted your editor-in-chief, Ben Smith. Does BuzzFeed serve as a sort of platform between The Dirty and the Olympian Heights of the New York Times?
So you're saying we're middle brow? I think the way that we look at the current media ecosystem is that everyone is competing with everyone, from the New York Times on down to some random guy with a Tumblr account who happens to have a scoop passed on to him. So I guess that we see our role as going in and engaging with the rumors and sorting out what's accurate and what's not, and doing it in a transparent way.
I understand BuzzFeed's business model, and there's nothing wrong with it. It uses news and listicles and visuals all as clickbait, and there's nothing wrong with trying to get viewers to your site. I just think that you're being a little disingenuous to say that if you don't pass along an unvetted story that may not be true is the same as pretending it doesn't exist.
To say that this was about business model or chasing clicks is not quite accurate. I mean, we got plenty of views on this story or these series of stories that we did. But I mean, it was nowhere near the, 15 cat pictures that will restore your faith in humanity posts that we do. I mean, we don't do these things because we think it's going to be great for our business model or bring us a bunch of views. We do it because we genuinely believe that this is the way journalism has to be done in the 21st century.
McKay, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on, Brooke.
McKay Coppins is BuzzFeed's political editor.
This week, British Prime Minister David Cameron announced a bold, two-pronged attack on both pornography that exploits children and the availability of pornography to children.
The fact that many children are viewing online pornography and that the nature of that pornography is so extreme it is distorting their view of sex and relationships.
The Cameron government has promised a battery of new measures in this offensive against the offensive. But chief among them will be for all new internet connections to include pornography filters enabled by default. Don't want the filter? Well, you'll have to check a box to opt out of it. Or, you might say, opt in to watching porn. The announcement has drawn criticism from people like Mick Wright, lead tech writer for the UK's Daily Telegraph, who says that not only is it a stifling invasion of privacy, but that Cameron's measures aren't going to have any impact on the pornography he's trying to stop.
One of the things that David Cameron is asking is that Google take a blacklist from CEOP, which is the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Center in the UK. Well, Google already does that. The government has actually cut funding to CEOP in recent years. So while talking tough about dealing with child sexual abuse imagery online, he's actually cut the funding. Most of the behavior by pedophiles and sexual abusers operates in parts of the internet that aren't crawled by Google. You know, these people are using peer-to-peer, they're using password-protected sites, they're using Tor. Those who say that they could easily stumble upon child pornography on the web, I think are scaremongering, because there is no earthly reason that you should stumble upon it these days.
And for people who just like looking at other people having sex online, are they going to be hampered in their consumer desires?
No, but they are going to have to declare themselves porn users. A company has a record of you saying, yes, I'll put my hand up and say, I want to watch pornography. And also, because it's going to be a decision you're going to have to make as a family, you're going to have to end up having a discussion with your spouse or your partner about your porn use, which you may or may not wish to have.
You say that while the problems are real, Cameron was just showboating here. Why?
Because the Daily Mail and elements of the tabloid press in the UK are seen as fundamentally important for winning the next election. And particularly, there's a sense that Cameron has not connected well with women and a certain type of middle-class woman who is thought to be very, very concerned about the corruption of childhood, the sexualization of childhood. And the day after he announced these policies, the Mail's front page was trumpeting its success in winning its battle against porn and child porn and the sexualization of children. And that's why I consider it grandstanding.
It's hard to know what actually Cameron is targeting in a country where the general circulation tabloids have topless photos on page 3.
Given that he's pro these filters, you know, to stop access to porn of all kinds, he was asked, would he back the campaign that is ongoing in the UK for Rupert Murdoch's son to stop publishing page 3 in the Daily newspaper featuring a topless woman? And he said, no, it's about consumer choice and people should be able to buy the Sun.
And then in the process of filtering out dubious internet searches, there is something, I just love this, called the Scunthorpe problem.
Yeah.
Tell me about the Scunthorpe problem.
Scunthorpe is a town in the north of England, and there is an explicit term within the name, a series of letters which spells out probably the strongest swear word either in the UK or the US, and filters are not sophisticated enough to know that you're searching for Scunthorpe and not searching for that explicit term. So Scunthorpe County Council can find its website being blocked because it's considered to be an explicit site with many references to that sexual swear word.
What else does Cameron have on his target list that will get further and further into the private lives of British subjects?
There's a kind of hazy notion of banning extreme pornography. Now, where the line is drawn is extremely difficult. There was a case of a civil servant in the UK who was brought up on obscenity charges because he was gay, and amongst himself and some friends, he was engaging in some pretty hardcore sadomasochistic behavior, and they were sharing pictures amongst themselves. He was found not guilty, but that's seriously affected his career. And there's a question of, you know, where you draw the line. And also, his idea of extreme pornography is going to include scenes of simulated rape. Now, the question there is how you deal with things like The Accused, you know, Oscar-winning film in which there are scenes of simulated rape. We are going to get into free speech issues. And unfortunately, unlike the US, the UK's law around free speech is a lot more difficult to apply.
If Cameron is serious in wanting to eradicate child sexual abuse imagery from British society, is there a way to do that?
The way you do that is through stringent policing. It's through investigative work. And fundamentally, what the government is doing with an austerity drive in the UK is that it is cutting the police and thinking that technological solutions will fill the gap. And they just won't. The way you find out about these individuals who are organizing paedophile rings is through quite traditional policing and investigation.
Mick, thanks very much.
No worries.
Mick Wright is the chief technology blogger for the Daily Telegraph.
Coming up, France's three strikes and you're off the internet rule is deep sixed.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Jumping off the two previous stories about the disruptive impact of the internet on the old order, we continue the theme. Now we'll focus on the behavior of individuals who harvest world culture from digital pastures of plenty and then spread it around, sometimes for fun, sometimes for profit. In other words, we'll spend the rest of the show on digital downloaders, the ordinary people and the pirates, and the many determined and disastrous attempts to rein them in.
This month, France announced that it was finally giving up on Adopi, the world's most hated anti-piracy law. Adopi's strategy was to give illegal downloaders three strikes before kicking them off the internet. But after almost 4 years, millions of euros, and only one disconnected user, it was clear that Adopi wasn't working. At all. TechDirt technology and digital rights reporter Glyn Moody wrote about Adopi's short, inglorious life. Welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
So back in 2009, when it was implemented, the French tech community exploded, and not in a good way. Why was Adobe so controversial? What did it do?
Basically, it was a pet project of the then French president, Nicolas Sarkozy. He just decided that those wicked pirates in this lawless land known as the internet must be punished. It was a really quite savage approach. It's notoriously hard to establish who is actually downloading things. But unfortunately, the way the law was framed was that the person who was named as being responsible was actually the person who ended up getting thrown off the internet.
So after 3 years and millions of euros, Adobe managed to convict two or three people and kick one off the internet.
The first person thrown off wasn't until very recently. It was only the end of last year, September 2012. And it was a really rather extraordinary story because during the court case, he actually got his wife to admit that she was the person who had downloaded two songs.
Mm-hmm. What were the songs?
They were actually a couple of Rihanna songs. But according to the Adobe legislation, because her husband, who actually turned out to be her ex-husband shortly afterwards, was the person who was named on the contract, he was the one that was thrown off. So somebody who didn't download any files still ended up paying a few hundred euros fine. And in fact, he was so disgusted, he said he'd never get the internet again, which seems a strange way to encourage people to spend more money on digital music.
Adobe died on July 8th. What precipitated that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one really very simple reason. An election had taken place previously, and Nicolas Sarkozy had been thrown out, and François Hollande, the socialist, had been voted in. Now, originally, he stated that he was going to get rid of Adobe completely. Once he got power, he slightly changed his mind and said, well, maybe we'll just sort of tweak it a little bit. But nonetheless, it was clear both to him and to his culture minister that Adobe was a complete and utter failure, whereas Sarkozy could never admit that it was a failure.
Okay, so we were watching this three strikes, you're out situation relatively closely. And I think that people who care about the internet all around the world were watching France to see how this played out. Does its failure mean the end of a graduated response to piracy in the rest of the world?
You're absolutely right. It certainly was seen as a trailblazer. A number of countries actually followed in France's footsteps. So South Korea, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom all adopted legislation which allowed for the possibility of a three strikes and you're out kind of approach. What's interesting is that none of those schemes has worked. Nobody now is really talking about cutting people off from the internet. The internet now, it's really like, you know, your water supply or your electricity. It's a fundamental necessity for modern life. So I think people realize that this is a completely disproportionate way of dealing with accusations. You may have downloaded two songs. Now, in the US, you have a six or even seven strike system, which actually strings out this warning process more and more. And I think that's not unreasonable in the sense that you're really suggesting to people it'd be a good idea to stop downloading things. Otherwise, we might have to do something.
Somebody who was explaining that law to us said that ultimately, if all their warnings are ignored, nothing happens.
That's right. But I think the fact that it has taken that form really, again, shows the failure of the French model, that it became clear that that was not only inefficient, but it really wasn't ethical.
You have been a critic of Adobe for as long as it has existed. Do you have an alternative approach for stemming piracy, or are you actually defending people's right to pirate?
Let's address the kind of practical question first. Can we reduce people making unauthorized downloads? And the answer is yes. As it happens, in the last couple of weeks, two reports have come out about what's been happening in Norway and in the Netherlands. And what they found was that when legal alternatives to illegal downloading turned up, like Spotify or RDO or Deezer, the rate of piracy plummeted in some cases by 90%. A year ago, there was similar research in Sweden, the home of Spotify, that showed the number of people downloading unauthorized files dropped by 50% once Spotify was available. What happened before was basically the copyright company said, well, we don't really like this digital world. Would you keep buying these pieces of plastic? And people didn't want to do that. They wanted to have it in a digital format.
So if you were going to sum up the piracy problem in just a couple of sentences, what would you say?
I would say that there's been a fundamental misunderstanding of what piracy is. This high moral viewpoint that it's really evil to download files from the internet. Really, what they're signaling is that they're not able to get things at a price that they consider to be fair. And sometimes they can't even get it at all. Once you make things available in a form that people want at a price that most people consider fair, they will stop going the difficult route of downloading stuff and getting poor quality copies, and they will get the official stuff from the people offering it and happily pay for it.
Glenn, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Glenn Moody is a longtime technology and digital rights reporter for TechDirt.
So there's a growing acknowledgement that punishing individuals won't stem piracy. But cast your mind back a decade or so ago, and you'll recall that the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, spent years pursuing and suing individuals for illegally sharing and downloading music. The group sent out letters to some 30,000, mostly young people, offering them a choice between settling for a few thousand dollars or a court battle. Those threatened, almost all, chose to settle. One kid who illegally distributed thousands of songs, including this one and the ones you'll hear in the next report, didn't settle. OTM producer Chris Neary has the story.
Now, the RIAA wasn't planning to cash in with these settlements. A couple thousand dollars was not the cure for the industry's plummeting profits. No, the settlement was merely intended to sting infringers and scare potential infringers. Here are a few old clips from college news services.
I was like, what is RIAA? So then I opened it and, you know, then it read like, you know, basically you're being sued by the recording industry. And then I was just like, oh my God.
Last night I talked with the RIAA and was able to come to some sort of an agreement. I'll have to pay them $3,000 over the next 6 months.
I mean, I probably got away easy because in the past I have downloaded music and $3,000 probably covers it. I probably will never download music illegally again.
Obviously, they settled. The recording industry had subpoenaed their internet records, and it was worth a few thousand dollars to avoid a court battle. The students were outgunned, and they knew it.
I had the distinction of being the judge with all of the file-sharing cases in the District of Massachusetts.
That's Nancy Gertner. Today she's a law prof at Harvard.
It was an extraordinary array of lawyers for the record companies who would sit at one table, and then individual A, B, or C coming with his or her mother or friend sitting on the other side, unrepresented and frequently having not the slightest idea what the proceedings were about.
Gertner took the unusual step of holding conferences in her courtroom with a dozen or more students, where she'd explain what was happening.
I didn't know what else to do. In about 2006 or 7, I began to offer a list of lawyers for people to use, pro bono lawyers, so that they could be represented if they chose to be represented. All of this was basically just to try to level the playing field.
One student who got a pro bono lawyer is still in litigation, 10 years after he received his first letter to settle. He's the last man standing in this battle. The judgment against him currently stands at $675,000.
My name is Joel Tenenbaum, and I'm a researcher at Boston University Department of Physics.
Back in the 90s, Tenenbaum put thousands of songs on peer-to-peer networks. Ultimately, the RIAA, who declined to comment for this report, sued for just 30 songs. How does he feel about those songs now?
They were probably picked among like the most popular songs they could possibly pick. And so now, of course, they're completely and entirely played out. So I can't really listen to them anymore.
I asked Tenenbaum, why didn't he just settle when he had the chance?
I think it's a ridiculous question. I think that that's like going to a schoolyard, seeing a bully beating up a little kid, and then going to the little kid and saying, why do you keep getting beat up?
Tenenbaum's pro bono lawyer is Charles Nesson, regarded as a legendary thinker on copyright. He's also regarded as an eccentric. In a student lounge, Tenenbaum explained how Nessun prepared him for a deposition.
There's the judge, who's the king, and the lawyers, who are the wizards. And the wizards will conjure up all sorts of spells in an attempt to persuade the king. Your role in all this is the farmer, and you have a goat, and you're sticking to it, and that's your goat. And you can just watch the wizards perform their various acts. I was like, oh, okay. And then I called up my mom and I said, Mom, what the hell do you think he meant by any of that?
Just think about it. You'll get it.
Early on, Tenenbaum didn't help himself. While answering written questions from the RIAA, he suggested that other members of his family might have been responsible for the songs on his hard drive. Then, during that deposition, he lied.
I mean, I admit that I probably said misleading things. I thought it was the best decision at the time.
Finally, in open court, he did take full responsibility for all that downloading and sharing. But his behavior damaged his case. And observers say it hurt him with the jury. And even though he was standing up to the whole recording industry, the media didn't see him as the good guy in the story. But his lawyer did.
Well, Joel, to me, is a man of a piece with Aaron Schwartz and Dan Ellsberg and Manning and Snowden. He's an individual who chose to challenge what he saw as injustice.
If that seems like a little much, you should know that 40 years ago, Charles Nessun defended legendary leaker Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers trial. That was a very public case, and Nessun wanted the same publicity for Tenenbaum. So he broke a state law by recording and posting a conference call with opposing counsel. And he argued strenuously, unsuccessfully, to have the case streamed on the web. Getting the story out there, Nessun reasoned, would turn the public against the recording industry.
The idea of an open defense was just what we wanted. We have nothing to hide. That was the thought.
Has that worked?
No.
Professor Nessun gave this very theatrical performance.
Ben Schaffner covered the trial. Now he's the vice president of legal affairs at the Motion Picture Association of America. But he spoke to me as a former journalist.
He brought in sort of a styrofoam cube, and he sort of crumbled it, and it sent pieces of styrofoam flying all over the courtroom. And he explained that this was his illustration of the changes in the music industry throughout the 90s and the 2000s, that the exploding bit of styrofoam was a representation of a CD sort of being atomized into individual songs.
Nessun's argument hinged on a novel application of the fair use doctrine, that since Tenenbaum's generation didn't have a way of legally getting digital music in the early 2000s, its downloading and sharing wasn't copyright infringement. But because he hadn't told the court he planned to launch that defense, under the rules, he wasn't permitted to present it.
The issue that I wish I had been better at crystallizing was the limited nature of the damage that Joel did. They succeeded in making themselves the victim of what everyone had done and of pinning it on Joel. I somehow should have been better able to protect him.
After Tenenbaum admitted to downloading the files, the only thing left was sentencing. The jury ruled he should pay $22,500 for each of 30 songs. That's where that $675,000 number comes from. The key thing to understand is that the RIAA sued him for statutory damages, not actual damages. Ben Schaffner.
Under statutory damages, the copyright owner does not actually have to show how much actual damages they incurred. In a lot of circumstances, it's difficult or impossible to figure out exactly how much in actual damages a copyright owner has lost. And that's especially true on the internet.
With no way to measure the actual damages in this case, the judge instructed the jury to choose a number between $750 per song and $150,000 per song, a range laid out by Congress in the Copyright Act. If they'd gone with the max, he would have owed $4.5 million. So that $675,000 number, that number actually shows leniency by the jury. After the decision, Gertner reduced the verdict to $67,500, but she was overturned when the record companies objected to a judge reducing the jury's penalty.
I somehow believed and continue to believe that underneath all of our laws and all of our statutes, there is a principle of fairness. The verdict in the case seemed demonstrably out of whack with what the companies had lost, what Tannenbaum had gained, whatever the measure, the traditional measure of damages had been.
In June, Tannenbaum and Essen lost an appeal on the judgment. They'll appeal again. Tannenbaum says he'll probably have to declare bankruptcy. The RIAA has long since stopped suing individuals. But critics of the judgment say that unless Congress narrows that huge penalty range or draws a distinction between people who make money by infringing and those who don't, like Joel Tannenbaum, this will happen again in other corners of the internet. A Chicago law firm has been obtaining the ISP records of people who have infringed on copyrighted porn. Those illicit downloaders are now being presented with their choice: settle for $4,000 or face that penalty of up to $150,000 per infringed work after a battle in open court. If jurors didn't have much sympathy for Joel Tannenbaum, how are they going to feel about someone who's been sharing porn?
For On the Media, I'm Chris Neary.
Coming up, a film about Sean and Sean, the Napster twins, and the writer who decided that helping his pirate was the wisest course.
They weren't really twins. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, with Kids Count, national, state, and local data on the well-being of kids at datacenter.kidscount.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at wix.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As we just heard, the RIAA lashed downloaders with punitive lawsuits, but it also tried to stop file sharing at its source. The trade group slammed a lawsuit on the popular file sharing service Napster soon after its launch in 1999. The record industry intended both to crush the service and to send its users a message. But the opposite happened. Trial coverage soon drew millions of people to Napster, particularly college students. Here's a young MTV reporter investigating the brand new file sharing bonanza. Yeah.
So how many MP3s do you have on your computer?
About 600.
Maybe like 100 or something.
6 or 7,000.
Come again?
6 or 7,000.
For real?
Yeah. They're all legit.
How many MP3s do you have on your computer?
Probably like 300.
For real? Where'd you get them from?
Truthfully, most of them from Napster.
That clip is from a new film called Downloaded, which looks back at the file-sharing pioneers who shook the music industry to its very foundations. The same industry which in 2001 finally won in court and dismantled Napster. Filmmaker Alex Winter talks to the two Seans behind the service, Sean Fanning, Napster's tech brains, and Sean Parker, the entrepreneur. The two met as teenagers on the internet. They only met in person after they'd already decided to collaborate. Here's Sean Parker, the entrepreneur.
And the door opened, it was Fanning, and he looked at me and he said, "You look exactly like I thought you'd look." And I said, "You look exactly like I thought you'd look." And he said, "Okay, great, let's go over the presentation." So we jumped into the PowerPoint and went through all the slides and then got in my parents' minivan, and my dad drove us to our first investor pitch.
Alex Winter says that much of what we think we know about the Napster story is fundamentally skewed. For instance, the record companies were not just bullies blind to the future.
You know, everyone sort of loves the idea of the kind of rebel kid going up against the man, you know, the David and Goliath thing. And the record industry and the movie industry and the government is not one entity that can quickly adjust itself to radically disruptive technologies. For all of the components to come together in a cabinet meeting, say, yeah, let's do business with Napster and change the world and then shake hands. That would never have been a practical reality.
In fact, the film does point out the irony, I guess, that taking up arms with the man were Dr. Dre, the hip-hop artist, and Metallica, the iconic metal band, both acts completely transgressive, and yet absolutely taking on the other set of bad boys, Sean Fanning and Sean Parker.
For Lars and Dre to stand up against what was clearly the next equivalent of a rock and roll revolution took a lot of bravery. What really did them the damage was the manner in which they sent the message.
The heavy metal band Metallica has been most vocal in its opposition to Napster, and drummer Lars Ulrich even plans on delivering a truckload of paper to the company, listing people who use its software to share unauthorized MP3s, thus kicking off Metallica's much-typed Monsters of Minutia-Filled Legal Battles tour.
In fairness, their point was never anti-technology. And Metallica has put their entire catalog on Spotify. I think their point was more, we got to draw the brakes and have a look at this thing because it's a huge rock in the water for our business. And frankly, 13, 14 years later, those issues remain, I think, in many ways, they're worse.
We hear a lot from Sean and Sean, Fanning and Parker, in the film. And on the one hand, we see a lot of them rationalizing Napster, that it's a peer-to-peer site for cultivating and sharing and community, not a piracy site. On the other hand, they're very straightforward about the effect of Napster, the wanton plundering of copyrighted material. Do you think they themselves have ever come to terms with the irresistible force versus immovable object question?
I think they came to terms with it back in the day. I met them in 02. People have such a cemented perspective on the Napster story due to the way it was spun in the media that they just take it at face value that it was a piracy service, and kind of how dare these kids not acknowledge that. And I think the reality of it is, for Fanning and Parker, it was never a piracy service. It wasn't. A piracy service would be something like Nutella, LimeWire, Pirate Bay, sites that are specifically philosophically constructed with decentralized servers so that they cannot be shut down. They cannot in any way do business with the record industry or the movie industry. They exist outside the laws of capitalism. And that wasn't Napster at all. Napster was built on the idea of creating a business model and doing licensing deals with the labels. They never made any money. They didn't get rich like a lot of the torrenting site guys did, because they were never able to do deals with the record industry.
It took Steve Jobs to do that.
Yeah, it took Steve Jobs to finally break that wall down. But I don't see those boys back at that time as rationalizing. I see them as genuinely having created something that in their hearts was going to create a better, more consumer-friendly system for them and their friends and then subsequently the rest of the world. I think that they believed in that system wholeheartedly, and I believe that they still do, which is why Parker puts so much effort into Spotify.
Yeah, on that very point. I mean, we're more than 10 years out from the introduction of Napster. Sean Parker is now frontman for Spotify, where a lot of the same issues remain.
I think it's unfair to kvetch about Spotify while iTunes basically pays the same as Spotify. And most kids are frankly on YouTube anyway. YouTube is a legal service that is using the same safe harbor clause in the DMCA that Napster was arguing in 1998 and 99, the exact same safe harbor
clause. That's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which gives safe harbor to online platforms from lawsuits about infringing on copyright when the infringements are created by the users and not by the company itself.
I think that there's still a lot of anger, a lot of litigation, a lot of resistance preventing a much more monetizable system that we could all be living in and will be living in at some point in the future. It's where we're going. It's just been a very bloody battle to get there.
There's a certain train wreck quality to Downloaded. You see the trains approaching one another head on. You see the collision, but you never really get to see a cleanup. Do you think the trains will ever be back on the rails, or are we facing infinite disorder in these markets?
I absolutely do not believe that we are going to live in chaos forever. I really don't. You know, as dramatic as all this stuff is, it's going to be a little bitty blip as we move from the industrial age into the technological age, which has been occurring for some time. I was very interested in looking at basically who's in the eye of the hurricane of a revolution and what does it feel like to be in that eye and what are the perceptions of you while you're in that eye. I think that's where Napster sits historically. It has enormous relevance. And that was what I was really interested in focusing on. I mean, surely I couldn't focus on how to clean up the train wreck because the trains are still wrecking. And the reality of it is that the locomotion industry is over anyway. So we shouldn't even be talking about trains.
Yeah, let's get out of that metaphor. Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alex Winter is the director of Downloaded, which is the story of Napster.
In Russia, book pirating is rampant. In fact, Russians have access to more than 100,000 pirated e-books and just 60,000 legitimate ones. For many authors and publishers, that is simply infuriating, and that often leads to lawyers getting involved. But when Peter Mountford, author of A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism, realized his book was being translated for a pirate Russian publisher, he did not hire a lawyer. No, he decided to take matters into his own hands, and that he did. He located the illicit translator online and helped him translate the novel, which is premised on a young man who's taken a job at a rapacious hedge fund.
He goes to Bolivia at the time of the election of Evo Morales, and his task is to see if he can parlay the election into something that the hedge fund can make money on.
Which is funny in the first instance, because Evo Morales is a socialist Hugo Chavez wannabe, right?
Exactly. In the process, he has a love affair with Evo Morales' press liaison, and hijinks ensue.
I haven't read it, but I'm sure it is delightful. And at least one Russian thought so, too. Tell me about the first hint you had that your book was in play in an unlawful way.
I had had a Google alert on the title of the book. I started to get a lot of hits from this Russian guy on a word reference forum online who was asking many, many questions about what I meant in all sorts of sentences in the opening of the book. I thought he was just a very eager Russian reader.
For example, you used the term cucumber walls to describe a pale green color, but this threw him.
He was really baffled, and he thought I might have meant that the walls were the texture of cucumber, or possibly, sort of inexplicably, he thought it might mean that the walls were paisley, which was really, really strange. And he asked this question.
Well, cucumber-shaped.
Yeah, exactly.
I can see why he might have guessed paisley.
I said a person was not towing the party line, and he thought that meant the person wasn't enjoying an actual party. I said somebody was suffering from white liberal guilt, and he said, "Is that mean the guilt that a person feels from doing cocaine?" And then he said to somebody, "I'm translating it for a Russian publisher." And that's when it occurred to me that he was a Russian pirate translator.
And then you started going back and forth with him? I mean, isn't that like driving up to your house and seeing a burglar trying to jimmy your windows and then grabbing your tire iron to help him? I don't get it.
The book had been out for a year, so the official Russian publishers had had opportunities to acquire the rights, and they had not made a move to do so. And so I was faced with the option of either having it pirated and published, and I wouldn't make any money on it, but at least people would read the book in Russian, or I could try and sort of put up a fight and stop the pirate translation, and then I would not only not make money, but nobody would read the book in Russian. And I thought that if the translation was going to be good, I might need to intervene. And so I sent him an email and said, "Hi, as the author of the book, I think I'm uniquely qualified to help you with this." And then after 2 weeks, to my surprise and delight, he wrote to me and said, "Thank you for contacting me. I would love to have your help." And there ensued this just barrage of questions. I've had hundreds of questions from him. And my wife was very stern with me and said, "You cannot spend a lot of time on this. You're not getting paid for it." And so I've been dashing off my responses.
Can you give me an example of the exchanges?
At one point, I described a character as being, you know, I said, reportedly a lethal diplomatic sniper. He was instead armed with a blunderbuss. And Alexander was totally baffled. He said, reportedly he was a brilliant diplomatic sniper, using his charm to hit from the first go and win people's hearts of the people whose cooperation he needed, but actually, and then it goes on and on and on, unsuitable for sharp shooting. He had a harbicus.
You call him Alexander, you know, as opposed to whatever his last name is, or that guy, or worse. Mm-hmm. What is your relationship with him? Are you friends? Are you colleagues? Are you adversaries?
Definitely colleagues. It's been cordial all along. We've never talked, I mean, almost never talked about the business aspect of it. We just talk about the text. Although when I published this piece in The Atlantic, there was an article in The Guardian. And as a result, he finally got wind of it. And he wrote me a very awkward email saying, I am not a thief. I basically said, evidence seems to indicate that you are, but I've enjoyed working with you. And we have since then, after he sent me this awkward email, we've continued to correspond about the translation. He has never asked me anything whatsoever about my life. It did come up for some reason that he is actually a biologist and he moonlights as a translator. At one point, he put the translation on hold because he had to take a very long train ride somewhere. I don't remember where. But he said, I'm going to be on the train for the next couple of days, so no work.
I want to ask you one final thing, Peter. You referred earlier to choices you had, whether to protect your intellectual property or to see that your work reaches ever wider audiences. And you suggested that it was an either-or proposition. Many have argued that piracy actually, in addition to increasing your audience of freeloaders, also increases your audience of paid buyers. We've learned this from the music industry, that some percentage of people who become aware of your work will actually pony up at a legitimate retailer.
I've heard Neil Gaiman say that exact point, where he has his book published legitimately and pirated in Russia, and he feels that the pirated version bolsters the sales of the legitimate version. I hope that that is true.
Are you done with each other? Is this it between Alexander and you?
I hope that we're not done with each other. I hope that he works on my next novel, which will be published in 2014. I would love to have an official Russian translation, and maybe he can help make that happen by getting my name out in Russia.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We spoke to author Peter Mountford last November.
Okay, so I'm going to use the last couple of minutes to work out an issue that has plagued my marriage for years. Those FBI warnings at the beginning of DVDs and Blu-rays threatening $250,000 fine and 5 years in jail if you copy the film, those warnings have been a constant irritant in my house. I'm calling my husband Fred, I'm recording him, and I'm not telling him either.
Hello?
Hi, honey.
Yeah?
I just wanted to ask you, can you tell me what it is you say every single time we put in a DVD?
Precisely?
If you can.
Oh, let me see. It's usually something like, you ought to do a piece about whether anybody has ever been prosecuted under this law. I think a lot of people would be really interested in that.
And what do I say?
You usually just ignore me.
And how long has this been going on?
Probably 10 years.
Yeah. Fred, I have your answer.
Yeah? Has there?
I'm going to play you the answer.
Okay.
The FBI's anti-piracy warning seal was specifically created to deter the illegal piracy of film and music and to increase the public's awareness regarding the penalties associated with the criminal copyright infringement.
Every time we put in a DVD or a Blu-ray, my husband says, and I mean literally every time, you ought to do a story on that. Has anyone ever actually been prosecuted for this? Has anyone? Come on, you got to find this out. And I just put him off for years and years, and this is his moment. So, Angela, speak to Fred.
As you probably know, sentences are determined based on various factors. They include whether or not, you know, a defendant cooperated, what the size of the criminal activity was. Here's a typical case where a guy got 4 years in jail for criminal copyright infringement. He was indicted by a grand jury for replicating and selling thousands of counterfeit copies of Norton Antivirus music DVDs and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon DVDs.
So you will only go after the big fish?
Yeah, we're not going after somebody that's usually just making one or two copies. I'm not aware of FBI resources ever being used in that respect.
It's kind of like the mattress tag that says, do not remove under penalty of law. You'll never go after me if I decide to make a copy of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon and give it to my kid.
Right.
So this warning is directed at precisely not the people that you are pursuing.
It could deter people from actually getting into that business because you never know the audience that you're really hitting.
Angela, thank you very much.
Well, hopefully Fred's happy with those answers.
Angela Byers is the FBI's Financial Crimes Section Chief. Well?
I think you've probably answered questions of several dozen people out there.
And it's answered yours?
Yes, and I suspected the deterrence thing was what was really going on here.
Are you relieved?
I mean, what's there to be relieved about? I guess I don't have to ask. I don't have to say anything at the beginning of a movie anymore. Are you taping this?
Yeah, the whole thing's recorded. Bye, sweetie.
Bye.
Fred. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sarah Abdurkhman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Olivia Wheats and Molly Buckley, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.